WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of us look back on our public school history classes and remember how dull some of our teachers managed to make the past. But the teaching of history is really a loaded subject. Educators designing a history curriculum have to decide how to interpret the most difficult issues of the past, issues of war and peace, slaves and slave owners, freedom of religion, religious tyranny, and so on. How to present historical controversies in a meaningful way to students of different racial, religious, and ethnic groups is a subject to which Diane Ravitch has given considerable thought. Ravitch was one of the principal writers of the K-12 history and social science curriculum for the state of California. She's an education historian, a professor at Columbia University Teachers College, and the author of the books The Schools We Deserve, What Do Our 17-Year-Olds Know?, and The Troubled Crusade, American Education, 1945 to 1980. Her new book is a multicultural anthology of history and literature called The American Reader. Ravitch is an advocate of multicultural curriculums, but she's against what she calls particularism. I asked her to explain the difference.
Well, what I've been trying to do in my work and in the articles I've written has been to define multiculturalism as pluralism and to say that ethnocentrism or particularism is not pluralism. And if you say, for instance, that you want to immerse yourself or your students completely in one strain, whether it's everything white, everything black, everything Hispanic, this is not pluralism. Now, it's possible in a school setting or in a college setting to, of course, do black studies or Hispanic studies or any other kind of studies, and that's fine. But I think that in teaching American history, particularly, that what you want to look for is the exchanges between people, the interchange, the interdependence, the fact that we're all part of this country and the society, and that the society has changed over time and continues to change over time. So I look not for the separateness and not for a sense of what I would consider a segregated curriculum, which I think some cities are moving towards today, but rather a curriculum in which we learn more about each other and we come to understand that we do, in fact, have a common culture with a lot of different streams in it that are all now part of the mainstream.
You've said that particularism is motivated by raising self-esteem and providing role models. Well, what's bad with that?
Well, we don't know whether segregated education actually does raise self-esteem. In fact, it may not. My notion, and I could be wrong, but my idea of self-esteem is that it's the product of doing something that you value and that others value. For instance, if you doubt your ability to do something, the best way to get your self-esteem raised is to do that task and do it well. You also get self-esteem by helping other people. There are many ways to get self-esteem. If your parents are wonderful to you and they make you feel good, then that you can get self-esteem that way. But I don't think that the way education proceeds is that you can dole out self-esteem by coming to believe that you're descended from whatever ancient ancestors. I think that's a certain kind of mythology.
I think what it's designed to be is an antidote to having been told for years or generations that you're inferior because of your religion or your ethnicity or the color of your skin.
Well, I don't think that anyone should be told that they are inferior because of religion, race, or ethnicity. In a pluralistic curriculum, it's very clear that people who do great things come from all civilizations and all colors and all religions. I think that it's very dangerous in history, particularly, to use history as a kind of self-esteem builder, because one of the things we learn in the study of history is that human beings of all races, colors, creeds, and ethnicities are capable of all sorts of terrible things. So that you would learn from history, I would imagine, if you took it seriously, a tremendous sense of humility. And that what counts is the kind of human being you are, and your caring for other people, and your ability to see other people and not see a skin color, not see a religion, not see an accent, not see age, but rather to care about human beings as such. That's an awfully hard thing to do, but to me that's the lesson of history, is that racism is always wrong. Ethnocentrism has tremendously negative consequences.
Diane Ravitch is my guest, and she's written extensively about education, and she's put together an anthology called The American Reader. Let's see what we can apply of this in practical terms. Now, you were one of the participants in rewriting the history and social science curriculums for the state of California.
Yes.
What were some of the problems with the existing curriculum that you were trying to correct with the rewriting?
What we tried to do in California with the history curriculum was to try to bring back history. There had been many complaints nationally as well as in California that kids didn't know much about history. So we set out, first of all, to construct a curriculum that would be interesting to children, that would be exciting to them, that would introduce them to important men and women, not only in American history but throughout the world, and that would give them an understanding of the connection between past and present. So among the things we did, because this is, I think it's very important in that it shows that pluralism works as a curricular concept, is we did the most radical thing that any curriculum committee has done anywhere in the United States. We introduced 3 years of required world history. And when I say that it's world history, I'm not speaking of Western history, or I'm not speaking of Western and non-Western history. I'm speaking of world history. And that is to say that in the sixth grade, all the children in California will have and now have a course in ancient history. In seventh grade, they have a course in history in the Middle Ages, and it's a world course, both of these courses. And then in the third year, which is the 10th grade, they have a course in modern world history. And there are some themes that run through this. There's great attention to ethics. We look at the religions of the civilizations of the world. We try to see history in a very broad and latitudinarian fashion, so that when we look at different civilizations, we look at things like their art, their literature, their government, the idea of human rights. How did people have any rights? How did the government get its power? What was the society like? What was the economy like? What were the religious beliefs? What was the daily life? What was ordinary life like for people? What were the things they believed in? And we did a kind of remarkable thing at the same time. We said to textbook publishers, pretend that you don't have a captive audience. Pretend that you have to win the respect of your reader as if people who read these books actually went out and bought them. This was a brand new concept in textbook publishing. What we did in the American history was we said 3 years of required American world history, and this is not new because that had been the case in California before, but we introduced into American history an attention to pluralism, and that was close attention, not just pretend attention and not just remember to mention a few blacks and a few women. We said that in all of the writing and telling of American history, there must be attention to the basically pluralistic, multicultural nature of American society and recognition that this is true not just for the recent past, but this has been true from the beginning, that the those who lived here before Europeans arrived had cultures and that their culture had to be understood. And we then look at all of the different cultures and the interchanges between cultures, which is very important to do. This is why having seen the development of a curriculum in which there is cultural interchange, I'm very opposed to an Afrocentric curriculum, a Hispanocentric curriculum, a curriculum where children are in a sense, treated to a kind of segregated approach to their own culture and not to others.
I'm wondering if this emphasis on multiculturalism through world history isn't a very far removed way of getting multiculturalism into students' curriculums. I guess it's harder for you to find the student sitting next to you or sharing your block with you through world history. Do you know what I mean? Through going that far back, it seems very abstract when you're young.
It's actually not abstract. And the difference in approach is this, and I think it's in learning history. I think it's very important to learn about things rather than to learn to believe in things. Now, if you want to go to parochial schools, you might want to learn to believe in things. But in a public school and in a university, we learn about. So, for instance, in the ancient history course and in the Middle Ages course, there is quite a lot of attention to African history. And there is in the textbooks that were based on this curriculum that were just published by Houghton Mifflin, there is very careful and very attentive treatment of the African kingdoms of Mali and Ghana and Songhai. Now, the idea is not to say learn to identify with these kingdoms, but rather that all children, regardless of whether they're Asian or Black or Hispanic or white or whatever their ethnicity, this is very interesting. These were important civilizations in world history, and you should know about them because of their intrinsic interest. This is very different from saying because you are of this skin color, you can identify with this civilization. The idea is that in the classes in California, as in most of the country, and certainly in the city that I live in, New York, classes are ethnically mixed. They're not always well integrated by race, but they're ethnically very mixed. We have Black children coming from the Caribbean as well as from the South, as well as from Africa, as well as having Latin American children who come from all over Latin America and from many different cultures. As well as Asian kids from all over Asia, as well as Asian kids who've been here for generations, and on, we don't have simply in this country five cultures. We don't have a white culture, a Black culture, a yellow culture, a red culture, and a brown culture. We have hundreds of cultures. And so if you say that we're going to teach you the culture of your ancestors, this is, first of all, pedagogically impossible in a classroom with 25 to 40 children, where there might be 25 to 40 different cultures. It isn't even possible in most cases for individual children where their parents may come from different cultures and their grandparents may come from yet other cultures. So I think that I'm not arguing the melting pot. I'm arguing the salad bowl, the mosaic, the multi-textured tapestry, call it what you will. We are too culturally diverse to call ourselves five races and therefore five cultures.
Now, the curriculum that you helped draw up in California has been very controversial. There have been objections raised by Black groups, Jewish groups, gay groups. What kind of issues did they raise, and how did you respond to them?
Well, the attack on the curriculum comes about not, I think, because of flaws in the curriculum, but because in this country we have a system of lay control of education, and since everybody at some time or another has been to school, everyone sees himself as an expert on schooling as well as an expert in his or her own particular culture. The basic thing is that everybody wants to write their own treatment. Religion, for instance, has not been in American textbooks for a generation. And there have been several studies saying that it's a disgrace that American kids in their history classes, whether they're learning world history or American history, religion doesn't exist. Now, there's a reason that religion doesn't exist. It's because it's controversial. And there has been a trend of extremist groups criticizing the schools for years. And the result of not just the schools, but the textbooks, and particularly the textbooks, the result of these extremist criticisms is textbook publishers studiously avoid anything that might be remotely controversial because they don't want to face the criticism. They don't want to have their textbooks labeled as controversial because they know that it'll kill their sales. And so we have these massive textbooks of 800 to 1,200 pages for kids in the eighth grade who study American history, kids in other grades who study American or world history. And the biggest criticism of them is that they're boring. Why are they boring? All the controversy has been dropped out. And that's why our curriculum was very path-breaking, because we said specifically, if you textbook publishers leave the controversy out, your books will not be appropriate for adoption. We want controversy. We want children to see different points of view. We want them to be able to see the process by which these controversies were settled.
I'm wondering if some people fear that the kind of multiculturalist curriculum you're talking about isn't writing through the vantage point of white Americans describing different cultures. So all the other cultures are always the outsider culture.
Well, I think that's a legitimate concern, and I think that I didn't write the textbook, so I can't say what their vantage point is. I know that they have a lot of primary source material written through the eyes of people of various cultures. In the anthology, The American Reader, what I tried to do is not to do anything through my vantage point other than the introductions, which is inevitable. But I have a lot of material by African Americans. I have a lot of material by people of other ethnic groups and by women. And, of course, it's their words.
New York State's history curriculum is in the process of revision now. And you've written some critical statements about the way the curriculum is progressing. I know there's probably a lot of really complicated inside stuff here, but if you could give us an explanation of your criticisms an explanation that those of us who aren't intimately involved in this would appreciate.
Basically, the question in New York State is that there have been criticisms that the curriculum as it stands, the state curriculum as it stands, is Eurocentric and biased. And I was one of the people called in to review the report that made these charges. And I reviewed the curriculum, and I thought it was one of the most boring curriculums in the country. But I did not think it was biased, and I did not think that it was Eurocentric. This was a curriculum that was revised in 1987, and at that time, the biggest complaint about the 1987 curriculum that came out at that point was that it had reduced the role of Western Europe to a point of being almost insignificant. And there were letters and petitions sent to the state commissioner in 1987 because the old curriculum had 1 year of Western European history and 1 year of non-Western history, and the new curriculum reduced Western Europe to one quarter of 1 year. So a number of people who teach European history throughout the state wrote and complained to the state commissioner that the kids would come to college not knowing any European history at all if all it was a quarter of 1 year. So then when 2 years later this very same curriculum was assailed as being Eurocentric because this is a curriculum in which Western Europe and Africa get equal time, I found it hard to take seriously the charge that this was Eurocentric, particularly because, as I said, I did read the curriculum and I did read the task force report, and there were no particulars evidence. There were just a series of charges. The charges were that, you know, that it was biased, that it was Eurocentric, that all white people have oppressed all people of color for centuries, etc. But this does not consist of a bill of particulars.
Is the curriculum being rewritten in response to the criticism that it's too Eurocentric?
Yes.
So that's the point of the rewriting.
Right, yes. In response to the original task force, which claimed that the curriculum is biased and Eurocentric, a new committee to revise the curriculum was created, and it has 22 or 23 people on it, and they've been charged with reviewing the curriculum, and they have met a few times, and I don't know what they will do, but I assume that they will come out with revisions. You have to understand that any curriculum can always be revised. We never have a perfect curriculum. Every curriculum can be improved.
This fear that the curriculum is Eurocentric, you know, that criticism, mm-hmm. Do you think that that's in a way a symptom of how segregated the New York City schools are and the schools of many cities? In the sense that as I know in a lot of schools there is true multiculturalism where there are people of a lot of cultures, but really in a lot of the cities there's a lot of schools that are 98-99% black, and that isn't reflected in any of the learning materials.
Well, the question is, to what extent should the learning materials reflect the racial composition of the classroom? And if a class is, let's say, 100% black, or if a school is 100% black or 99% black, should it have a curriculum that's completely Afrocentric? Should those children therefore learn nothing about anything other than black Americans, African Americans, and Africa? And conversely, should children who attend a school somewhere, wherever, there, if there is a 100% school somewhere, should they learn only about the white part of American history as well as only about Europe? And I would say that both of those things would be wrong because it doesn't reflect reality and it's historically inaccurate. Those are both biased presentations. Children who are growing up in this country need to learn about American history as it happened, which is that it was that the African-American role in American history was very significant, and whether the school is 100% white or 100% black, the American history that's taught ought probably to be roughly the same, because Frederick Douglass should be as important in the white school as he is in the black school, even though he may assume more importance in the black school because he's a role model. But I would argue that he's a role model in the white school as well, because this is a man of intelligence and courage who would be a role model to the child who is Asian or white or Hispanic or anything else.
My guest is Diane Ravitch, and she's written extensively about education. She's also helped revise California state curriculum. She has a new anthology, a multicultural anthology called The American Reader. Where do you stand on extending the school year? This is an issue that's been coming up for years, but it seems to be getting raised very seriously right now.
Well, I think that I stand strongly in favor of extending the school day. I have written in New York about I think it was the president of the Board of Education, Gwendolyn Baker, suggested that there should be a longer school day. I happen to believe that that's more important than a longer school year.
Well, why a longer school day? I couldn't imagine myself staying in school any more hours than I already did, you know, in high school and in junior high. There's only a certain amount of time you could sit in a chair and absorb things, especially when you're young and you have all that physical energy.
Uh-huh. I think what's happened now is the school day has been shortened to the point where kids just don't have enough time to learn. In New York, the kids get out of school at 2:20. A lot of kids have no place to go when they get out unless they go to work in a job somewhere. But a lot of kids, especially younger kids, have no place to go because one or both parents are working and no one's home. So they're on the streets, they're latchkey kids, and all these facilities in the schools are closed up. And what I've thought would make a lot of sense in an extended day would be to have available people to help kids with their homework, to have computers available, to have foreign language instruction available, to have arts classes, dance classes, any number of things, sports, whatever. But this would be a period that would be tremendously useful to kids, and I think it also would be very important for parents to know that their children were being taken care of and protected rather than out on the streets because the school door got locked at 2:20 or 2:30.
And so I know you'd rather see that than extending the school year, but do you think extending the school year would be a good idea?
Oh, I think that it's just such a deeply ingrained tradition mm-hmm. that everyone has the summer off that I'm not sure that that's going to work. I know that in Los Angeles, where it's been tried, they seem to feel that it's successful, but they haven't really extended the school year so much as they've put everyone into year-round classes, and you get the same amount of time off, but you just take the time off at a different point rather than in the summertime. I think the big problem is that given the amount of time we have, I just don't think there's enough time in the day. I also think that it would be good if schools opened at 7. I've seen, again, some experimental schools that were open from 7 in the morning till 7 in the evening, where the parents could have the satisfaction of knowing that when they dropped their kids off at school on the way to work, that the children were at school and they were not getting into trouble or that they were not in danger. And they knew that in afternoons the kids had some good activities to choose among. I'm not saying that kids should be sitting at a desk from 7 to 7.
Some of these hours would be optional, I hope.
The schools that I've seen it in, I'm thinking now of a school in an experimental school in Chicago. It's really a benefit for the parents because they have young children ages 3 to 7, and the parents leave for work at 7:30. And if mm-hmm. in the normal school, they can't drop their kids off at 7:30. So this way, it's really a way of having the school help the parents out. And I think when you see what's happening in many of our cities and suburbs and other parts of the country, where the family is in different stages of disarray, I think that there could be a different role configured for the school.
Let's try to end on a really positive note. What gives you the most hope about the future of American schools?
Well, I think that the most hopeful sign is that we've begun to recognize some of the problems. I think that we have some really super people who are teaching and who have more courage and fortitude than almost anyone I've ever met. Every time I'm in a school, I'm impressed with not everybody there, but an awful lot of the teachers, and with the willingness that they have to fight for literacy and to struggle to get across what they have to do. I guess that I have to say that there are times when I despair because I feel that parents are not playing the role that they should play, and an awful lot of parents despair because they feel overwhelmed by the burdens of work and parenthood and everything else. But I think that the best sign of hope is the fact that people are talking about the problems, are trying to do something about it, and I don't think the problems are going to be solved unless an awful lot of people pitch in.
Well, Diane Ravitch, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Diane Ravitch is a historian of education. She's written extensively about American education, and her new book is A Multicultural Reader called The American Reader.